Empire podcast this week. Gore! Gore everywhere! Gore Verbinski, that is, as the director of A Cure for Wellness pops by for a chat. Plus the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that just feels triumphant right now. Triumphant. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you this week by mustard.co.uk, the insurance comparison site that helps you save time, money, and effort. After the glory of last week's, well, there's only one word for it, really, triumphant 250th podcast, which featured a live audience and amazing anecdotes from amazing anecdote machine Christopher McQuarrie, we're back in the mundane surroundings of the Pod booth as we embark upon the next batch of 250, which will take us up to the year 2022. 2022, people. God help us all.
That's terrifying.
That's a terrifying prospect for everybody concerned. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, and you'll soon see why, is our online editor, a man who is basking in the glory of being somehow the only journalist in the world, to get his name on the DVD cover of Rogue One. Please welcome the triumphant James Dyer.
You really are a dreadful human being.
Triumphant.
It was.
That's what it says.
A personal triumph for me. But I applaud the I applaud Disney for identifying me above all other, dare I say it, humans in the world. Yeah. That they sought my validation for this film, and as long as I liked it, they were happy, and that's nice.
What does the word triumphant in your Rogue One review refer to?
I really couldn't tell you.
Can you remember?
I have no idea.
Can you remember using the word triumphant?
I'm doubted. I'm kind of a hack, so probably. yeah. I almost certainly called it triumphant at one point. They clearly seized on that. And they
surely it wasn't in reference to Michael Cicchino's score, which I know you have a massive problem with.
Cicchino's triumphant score. No, I didn't. I don't remember. I'd actually have to go back and have a look at it. But this was a bit of a kind of career high moment for me. Having been on set of Empire Strikes Back when I was 5, and then now my name is on the Star Wars.
But no, it's great.
I'm done.
I'm very happy for you.
I'm going to retrain as a teacher now because I feel I have achieved. It's like in when you play video games, you know, when you get an Xbox achievement. This is my journalism. My journalism Xbox achievement for 10 points has just popped up on the screen.
Yeah.
And I can now uninstall the game and do something else.
It's like Ali Plum, formerly of this parish, and now at a much bigger parish over at Radio 1, has his name up in Leicester Square at the moment on the few Leicester Square.
Does he?
Yeah, with the Lego Batman. It says ridiculously fun or ridiculous fun Ali Plum, which is much a description of Ali Plum as it is,
yeah, it is
of course, the movie. So that's pretty cool. That's very cool, you know. But it's not as good as triumphant on the cover of a DVD.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm now basically the celebrity guest for this week's podcast. I mean, if we get right down to it, as someone personally associated with Star Wars and clearly the most famous person in this room, would you like to ask me?
I have a question. Uh-huh. Disney, what have you done? Look at the monster you have created.
I know. Do they not see?
Do they not see?
They're like the Mads Mikkelsen character, Lars Eldridge. What was his name? Galen Erso, that's
Galen
him.
Erso.
Lars Eldridge.
He's probably played that at some point.
He probably has. Lars Eldridge. Galen Erso.
I think this has been a long term goal for me. It is in many ways a triumph of the will.
Oh no.
It's a triumph of the will. No.
Let's move on.
Like one.
Yes.
All right, last but not least, we have our geek queen, a lady who also got the word triumphant onto a DVD, this time of Supernatural Season 11. But then the man at HMV made her wipe off the Tippex and pay for the damages. It's Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
Just a little tick here.
Yeah, that's well done.
Go.
Yeah, there's your Supernatural reference.
Supernatural. I could have also gone for on the poster for Hamilton.
For Hamilton, which is on buses now. It's happening.
It's tougher to write Tippex on buses. They tend to move. They're moving targets very, very hard.
I mean, they don't move very fast.
You will not be deterred.
No.
He's in London, isn't he?
He is, yeah. He's filming Mary Poppins Returns.
Uh-huh.
With a dreamy cast, actually, at this point. It really is.
Cast.
No, it's awesome. Angela Lansbury is in it, people. Come on.
Did you hear the anecdote, Richard Schiff's anecdote of meeting Lin-Manuel for the first time?
No.
He, obviously, Lin-Manuel's a massive fan of The West Wing.
Naturally.
Schiff, obviously, in the West Wing, and he had just for
just
people,
to
people at home
no,
who
no,
may
no.
not know.
I just remember something, yeah. but it's fine.
Okay,
I'll talk about that
afterwards. He tweeted to his followers, "Oh, hey, I've just got tickets to Hamilton. We're about to go in." Got a tweet back from Lin-Manuel, who follows him,
yes.
and he says, "Oh, what are you afternoon, morning? What performance are you in?" And he said, "I'm in the afternoon. Didn't hear anything else about it." And then after the performance, someone said, "Do you want to come backstage?" And Lin-Manuel was there. He comes up to him and meets him, and he's like, "Did you see it? Did you see it?" And he'd done a thing where he puts his hand on his chest. He was being full Ziegler, and he did it because he knew Schiff was in the audience. And Schiff's like, I mean, he thinks Hamilton is the greatest expression of art of our lifetime. Mm. I mean, he thinks it's the most amazing thing ever. And Lin was basically said, "I made this because of you. Do you know what? Yeah. This was inspired by you on the West Wing," and it kind of blew
his
mind.
This is the thing you need to understand about Lin-Manuel Miranda. He's one of us.
I know.
He's 100% one of us. He's a massive nerd. He follows Patrick Rothfuss as well, for God's sake.
I know. There's two chat on
Twitter.
Yeah,
they chat on
it's
Twitter
genius.
All the time.
Does he follow you on Twitter?
Not yet.
Does he follow? He doesn't follow me.
He almost certainly follows me now, having seen my name on the Rogue One box. So,
have you had a bump on Twitter?
I had a bump on Instagram, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Because I posted the thing on Instagram, and
of course you did.
Of course I did. Because I'm that kind of dreadful bell end. And I got a bump there. Yeah, it's just a matter of time until I am well.
It's amazing.
Famous.
It's right in the middle of the DVD as well. So
and
it's the only one. There are actual film journalists they could have chosen. And instead, they went for this thing. Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's okay. And you know, Helen didn't get on the.
No, I think
the
Force Awakens
cover.
Yeah.
You could have had, you know, Kylo Ren as the best Star Wars villain.
Yeah, they could have.
It could have been
and they would have been right, Chris. All right, they would have been right.
You know, I haven't written any Star Wars reviews
ever. Not ever.
No.
No, never in the past in history. Anything notorious? Nothing.
No, I'm not allowed anymore.
No. John Nugent trolled me on this. He said, "Was it Titanic amongst the Star Wars?"
Oh, dear.
Which is a reference, of
a
course,
reference
to your
my
passengers review.
Review. Yeah. Yeah. Four Star Empire.
Triumphant.
Yeah.
Talking about Richard Schiff reminded me of the time. Do you remember this when we...
The walk and talk.
we were we did weekly Fitty blogisodes.
Yeah.
Very briefly. For about 10 weeks, they were sponsored or something. And we used to do video diaries, which we call Fitty blogisodes. If you don't know, seek them out. They're on. Some of them are on YouTube.
Yeah.
And we're very proud of some of them. Less so of others.
Mark Strong's
giant floating heads. Yeah. All the different parodies.
Anything involving Fitty blogisode, man.
Mm. Less proud of that. But,
look it up, people.
So we used to do them at Cannes, we used to do them at Comic-Con, we used to do them at the London Film Festival. And then we did weekly ones as well. And Richard Schiff, for reasons I cannot even begin to recall, was in the Empire offices one day, and we decided to ask him to do a West Wing parody, and you can see I'm doing air quotes in the biggest possible way, where I went up to Richard Schiff and went, "Richard, walk with me." And we walked through the corridors of Empire, get into a lift, and then Sam, the cameraman, had to run down the stairs to meet us at the bottom of the stairs, panting out of breath by the time the lift got down, and we were just talking about bollocks. And he said to us, he's turned down everybody asks him to do this, and for some reason he said yes to a bunch of amateurs with a video camera.
And he's since turned down everyone else because it was such a terrible experience.
No, because
it's
the apotheosis, isn't it? Once you appear on an Empire Footy blog episode, then your career's over.
You also left out the critical fact that we utterly fucked it up on about 8 different takes because we couldn't keep the lift doors open.
That's
and
right,
they kept closing.
Yeah.
So not only did we make him do it, we made him do it really badly.
And he was such a nice guy,
he
very patient
man,
because
yes.
we obviously don't know what we're doing. As should
That's
be evident.
Obvious to anyone listening.
By now.
I mean, we've been going for 10 minutes and we've barely done the introductions.
Good times.
So, yeah. No, I've introduced you.
Yeah.
I've introduced myself.
So when
the mustard
there?
Thing. We're good.
Yeah.
Oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda's here. I forgot to mention him. No, he's not.
I would have been squeeing in the background.
Yeah, you would not be able to contain yourself. What would you do?
I would be fine, I think.
Would you?
All right, yeah.
Would you?
I interviewed Keanu the other week. Come on. I can handle anything. I'm strong like bull.
It's true. I was the one giggling and tittering less so, Helen. So
oh, I don't know.
You were quite good.
We were both quite giddy when we got out of that.
I still haven't heard that interview. I need to check it out. And if you want to check out the Keanu Reeves interview, thank you for the segue.
Hey.
It is part of our John Wick Chapter 2 Spoiler Special Podcast, which is available right now, both with Keanu Reeves talking to these two grinning morons and the director, Chad Stahelski, and then us as well talking about the film. That's probably less essential.
And though, I have had, just to say, I've had a couple of people at me overnight since this went up and say how infectious his enthusiasm for the film is, yeah, and his clear love for the character and the whole universe of John Wick. And honestly, that's at least part of what made us as giddy as we were that day. He's just, his enthusiasm is incredibly contagious and it's lovely. So it's definitely worth a listen.
Yeah, fantastic. No, absolutely. Keanu is as happy as Larry. He's the anti-sad Keanu at the moment. Shall we have a question?
Yes.
Finally, what are we now? Minute 30?
15 minutes.
Okay. This is from Alan Hemmings and it's via email. If your life could be scored by any film composer, who would it be and why? Would Ennio Morricone haunt the audience with a foreboding harmonica during your commute? An after work trip to Tesco. Hang on a second, Alan Hemmings. Are you following me? No, of course not, because I'm a Sainsbury's guy. Reward card.
Come on, Nectar, you're points, Aldi all the way.
Nectar points FTW. How about a rousing yet somehow heart-wrenching Michael Cicchino score? James is shaking his head.
No.
As he reminisces about Tesco not having any gluten-free crumpets left. Okay, clearly he's not following us because none of us
are
into
gluten-free
stuff.
Yeah.
Gluten-free waffles.
I mean, obviously John Williams, because my life is epic.
Well, yeah, but what kind of Williams? You're saying epic, hard-hitting Private Ryan Williams, or, you know, whimsical Williams, a bit Harry Potter-esque?
No,
you?
I'm saying late 70s, early 80s Williams. Come on. Be serious.
Helen contains multitudes.
I do.
And, you know, so John Williams could convey any part of your life.
Exactly.
Any emotional high.
I mean,
that's a good choice.
Lots of emotional love.
It's a bit first base.
It
obviously
is.
Well, then I'm going to go a little bit more, you know, home run or something now. Daniel Pemberton, I also really rate. I've had a bit of a listen to some of his stuff recently for reasons. Well, he was at Empire Live and I interviewed him on stage. He's a very nice man. I think he'd, you know, we could sit down, have a chat. He'd do a good job. It'd probably be quite depressing if he got my life like 100% spot on, because it'd be a very, very simple and boring score. But, you know, if he took a bit of a flight of fancy with it, we could have some fun.
Just to clarify, are we talking about this in the when the biopic of our lives, which in my case will inevitably happen?
Because you're so that, famous when,
yeah,
now.
Yeah, so I'm famous now. And it will obviously be Williams. Are we talking like...
It will simply be called Triumph.
Benedict Cumberbatch is James Dyer. Just building up to the moment that you write the... write the review of Rogue One, and there's, you know, a 5-minute montage of him trying to come up with the right word.
Good?
Yeah, good. No. Great. No, it has to be something better than that. Ooh, let me look through the dictionary. Triumphant.
Yes.
Anyway,
are we saying it's that, or is this a Stranger Than Fiction type affair where we're walking down the street and just the orchestra swells?
I think it's a Stranger Than Fiction thing, isn't it?
I think you'd want to mix then, because I see myself descending on The Office to Rise of the Valkyries.
Wagner, yeah. Wow, okay. First Triumph of the Will, now Wagner.
Yeah, this
is going really well for you.
I don't know. I sometimes, you know, on Press Week, I'm thinking sort of a Johan Johansson kind of Sicario type grinding industrial thing, maybe.
Okay.
Is probably appropriate, or you know, something a bit of Alan Silvestri.
Oh yeah,
and a bit of Predator type.
Obviously, I was
or
thinking
Back
more.
The Future, take your pick.
I was thinking more Avengers, but okay.
He is a man of endless versatility.
Yes. Yeah, and his scores don't sound similar, which is
no,
good.
Which is very
was
good.
It was it Dark Knight Rises that Zimmer shared the score writing duties? Or was it?
He shared certainly the first two with James Newton Howard.
Right. Okay.
I'm not sure about The Dark Knight Rises.
So, but James is really, you are more seeing, do you remember years ago in the Vanity Fair Hollywood issue, they did a spread where they just took pictures of all of the major film composers. It was amazing because this was the 90s. We didn't really have IMDb. There was this spread with picture of all the composers and then some of their sort of greatest hits. And I remember being absolutely fascinated by it. The fact that they called them Bernstein East and Bernstein West, because there was Leonard and Elmer, and stuff like that. And yeah, so you would basically recruit that spread of like 20 composers to take turns.
Or just like mix and match. So like I have James Horner, you know, doing a combo with Junkie XL for my kind of breakfast montage. and then we kind of slip into something, I don't know, a little bit different in the afternoon.
a bit Johnny Greenwood in the afternoon. And, yeah.
Or, you know, I don't know. Or I could whimsically stroll around the building to Snuffy
You've
Walden.
Never whimsically strolled anywhere.
That's true. Yeah.
It is like, beyond you.
You know, like when Leo does the big walk and talk at the very beginning of the first episode of The West Wing, which is the music that they also use over the end credits, which is that plinky plonky playful one. That could be my theme.
My friend Sam and Wheatles, hey guys, walk down the aisle to that.
Did they?
Yeah. That was their exit music.
To which one?
To the West Wing end credits theme.
Oh, how's that go?
What's funny
is... It sounds better when he
Tommy Schlamme, who directs, he to this day can't work out why he used that for the end credits, because if you have a really somber episode that ends, which they often do, it then goes into this really peppy, light-hearted credits music, and it's really jarring. Mm. It's a slightly odd choice.
This has been the West Wing Weekly brought to you.
Hashtag the West Wing Weekly.
It's good.
So, Chris, who would Trent Reznor?
Trent Reznor. Trent Reznor. No? Yes, Trent Reznor. I, this is a really, really tough question. Because, again, like Helen, I contain multitudes. It's true.
Oh, sorry, yes.
I don't know. I love John Carpenter, but I think he's a little bit too dark for the sort of stuff I do.
That would be... Imagine walking home at night and you can hear John Carpenter music. Come on.
So you can actually hear this. I can hear this music.
Yeah, like... Is that what we're establishing? Yeah, it's Stranger Than Fiction style.
Okay,
yeah.
So I can actually hear the music. In that case, no, not John
Definitely
Carpenter.
Definitely not John Carpenter.
Who wrote the Benny Hill music?
I don't know.
Because I'm saying that's a contender.
Who's the big rom-com king? That would be fun.
The rom-com, the king of rom-com music.
Music, yeah.
I don't know, but...
No, I don't really either.
I don't know. You know, I love Jerry Goldsmith stuff.
Oh, yeah.
James Horner was great, obviously, as well. Danny Elfman.
Good
show. You're walking through a dark, scary wood at night. Boom, 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 boom. Less good if you're in Tesco buying gluten-free waffles or whatever it is. But I don't know. I'm drawn towards... You know, if you don't really want to go for people who are long dead, like the Elmer Bernsteins of this world or the Bernard Hermans, Lalo Schifrin is still alive. The guy who did the music for Dirty Harry, the guy who wrote the Mission Impossible theme, he'd be pretty awesome. Yeah. I'd be quite happy with that. Or if you wanted to delve into the world of TV, which I think is dominated particularly by two absolute colossies. Let's say that. Colossos. Whatever. Mike Post. Be good to be soundtracked by Mike Post. Or the late, great Ronnie Hazelhurst.
Well, if we're getting into TV, I demand Bear McCreary.
Bear McCreary. Oh, my God, yes.
He's the guy who did Great Chill and Blockbusters.
Battlestar
music is spectacular.
Okay. Yeah, it is. In fact, that is genuinely, if you ever need to type fast, highly recommend Battlestar Galactica. Passa Caglia works. If you look that up, there's a playlist online that then goes into like Allegro or some other ones. It is fantastic.
Remind me how the Battlestar Galactica theme goes.
No, it's complicated. There's lots of drums.
His All Along the Watchtower was an unofficial theme of my life at one point.
Oh, it's a good theme. True.
Yeah. I'd quite like, I know this isn't strictly composers, but I'd really like, you know, 80s pop act Yellow.
Like, from
The
Secret of My Success.
Well, from
Ferris Bueller,
of course, but also The Race, made famous by Nuns on the Run.
I always associate that song, weirdly enough, with The Secret of My Success, and not
Ferris Bueller.
Where it was used first and better. That's it. We've got a winner.
We're done.
We've got a winner. And I'm sure to Alan Hemming's satisfaction. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, and frankly, why wouldn't you? We're on email, podcast@empireonline. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And of course, we're on Twitter as well as @EmpireMagazine. Please use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't be able to see it. Okay, time now for movie news. And we're going to start off with the hard sell. Because it is Friday the 24th of February, am I right?
Sure.
I said April there for a second. And that means that the new issue of Empire is now on sale. It came out yesterday in all good and evil newsagents' price, just £4.50. And it is, as ever, another belter of an issue. Tons of great stuff inside it. Who's this on the cover?
It's Wonder Woman! Hooray!
Who?
Wonder Woman.
What's she been in? Have I seen her in anything before?
Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and the Lego Movie, and Lego Batman, sort of.
Surely yes. That would be the theme tune for you, wouldn't you? You'd want the electric cello.
That wouldn't be bad, actually.
Oh,
that would be pretty cool.
Good theme.
But yeah, this is the sort of basically a look at, you know, what's taken so long and why it's 75 years more than to get Wonder Woman to the screen. So that was a lot of fun. Spoiler, I went on set and talked to some people about it, and that's been really good. And the pictures are astonishing. Mm. Chris Lupton's opener for that feature is a thing of beauty. We've also got some Alien Covenant in there as one of the first looks. We have, what else do we have, Chris? You're actually leafing through it, and I'm trying to remember everything.
It looks very good. I mean, I would definitely buy this.
Thanks, Chris.
£4.50. All right, let's go through this. Big sale. All right, here we go. Page one.
No.
Oh, okay.
Bit,
all right. We'll skip. So Wonder Woman, Helen was on set. Talked to Gal Gadot, I believe. Is that how you pronounce it?
Gal. Oh dear. Is it okay?
Gal.
Everybody kind of said Gal. I'll be honest.
I've heard Gal, I'm also hearing Gal.
All right. Well, that would maybe make it might be that we're just kind of slightly Englishifying it.
Okay.
Right. Let's move on. Gadot for it.
Oh dear.
That was untriumphant. Then we have Free Fire. We have a feature on Ben Wheatley's Free Fire. I went on set in Brighton. When did I go on set in Brighton? A long time ago. Mm. In a galaxy far, far away. Wasn't this just
Brighton
down the road?
Yeah. And well, I might as well be with Southern Rail. Am I right?
You're so right. Oh. You are so right. No, it was a lovely journey. Very nice day.
Okay.
And I spoke to everybody in the cast: Brie Larson, Armie Hammer, Cillian Murphy, Michael Smiley, Jack Rayner. Who else is in that cast? There's some amazing people.
Your man. Yeah, your man.
Charlton Copley.
Indeed.
Him. And Ben Wheatley about how he staged a massive shootout. If you don't know what that movie is, it's a group of people in a warehouse and they all start shooting at each other. Then we also have a feature on Ghost in the Shell. Scarlett Johansson.
Indeed.
Johansson. Boldly going where no manga has gone before. An adaptation of the classic anime. We have a feature on the French cannibal movie Raw.
So exciting. Really, really excited to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Feature also on Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast.
Tale as old as time.
Mm-hmm. And the new Disney live action animation adaptation. The Empire interview this month is Ian McShane. The terrifying but brilliant Ian McShane. Then we also have a report from the set of Netflix's Iron Fist, our latest Marvel series. And a really interesting feature on How Green Was My Valley, which
yes.
is the movie that beat Citizen Kane to the Best Picture Oscar all those years ago. So yes, we're reporting on the movie that is better than the best movie ever made.
Die Hard.
Evil Dead 2. Etc, etc. Also in the issue, we have new images from the likes of Alien Covenant, as Helen mentioned, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, Borg McEnroe, which is not, of course, a new Star Trek movie, but a movie about the rivalry between Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe. And who is John McEnroe in this movie?
Shia LaBeouf.
Correct. That's exciting.
Isn't it?
That is exciting.
I was trying desperately to think of a resistance as futile pun there, but I know so little about tennis. I don't know any tennis terms, let alone one that sounds like resistance. Helen, help me out.
I don't know that there are many that sound like resistance.
So you're saying this was a flawed endeavour from the get-go?
I'm afraid it probably resists
Damn
deuce.
It.
Or there might be like a resist deuce, but it would be really forced. It wouldn't work terribly as a pun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Resistance is fault. No, it's not. It's not going to work.
Resistance is faultile?
No, it doesn't. Like, it doesn't. Yeah, no. It's really forced. Like,
there's
even
no humour here.
Even for us. There is nothing.
Yeah, you're right. It's a bad racket to get into. We shouldn't be courting any more puns, that's for sure.
Oh, that's terrible. Yeah, you've really hit the baseline now.
Yeah. That's the service I try and provide.
Oh, dear. I also wrote about American Gods there. I saw
that
page. Yeah, that was fun.
Okay, sorry, I'm just looking through.
And, of course, that's another thing that Ian McShane has coming up. He will be playing Mr. Wednesday in that, which is extremely exciting.
He does. What else do we have? We have a report about Jordan Peele's new movie, Get Out, which is not a comedy, but a very timely political horror. We have an on-set report from King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. The pint of milk this month is Dame Joan Collins.
That is amazing.
Which is astonishing. And no, we didn't ask her how hairy her arse was, because we draw a line somewhere.
There's got to be a line.
I didn't ask, for example,
down the middle, presumably.
Oh no.
Oh no. No. No.
No. No to that.
It's not too late to have the DVD recalled from the sale. Just remember that. No, I didn't ask De Niro how hairy his arse was when I did Pound Milk with him. Because there's just...
He was in Dirty Grandpa. Like, there's...
I know.
I think he'd have been fine with it.
I don't think he would have been fine with it. I think it would have been the end of the phone call. I always leave that question to the very end anyway.
What are the... Can you think off your top of your head, what are the times when that's gone the most awry?
It hasn't ever gone awry for me. It went awry for Phil when he interviewed Eric Cantona.
Yes.
And he said, how hairy is your arse? And Eric Cantona thought he was asking, how airy is your house?
Yes.
On a scale of 1 to 10.
No. The bigger problem was that he omitted the suffix. So it was not, how hairy is your arse on a scale of 1 to 10? He just said, how hairy is your arse? Please describe in as many adjectives as possible the thicket surrounding your buttocks. That went a bit wrong for him.
Well, Phil also interviewed Dame Joan Collins for this. I was privileged. In fact, I think most of us were to be sitting next to him when he was doing this interview. Mm. This is a very, very strange thing. I mean, I don't do interviews on the phone in the office.
No, you don't.
Because I don't like people listening to my...
And laughing at you.
...interview style. And which is weird, says a man who does interviews publicly for the podcast. But that, anyway, it's a little foible of mine. But Phil just happily did it. And he talked to Dame Joan Collins. And we stopped at one point with it because he started talking about camel porn. And all you heard from Phil, obviously you can hear John Collins' side of the conversation, but you hear Phil going, "Yeah, so do you watch camel porn? Is that something? No, okay. What the hell is happening here?
She's a dame, Phil. Have some respect.
How did it come up? I want to know."
But it's he was so polite about it. It's not, are you watching camel porn? It's, are you watching camel porn, Dame Joan?
Dame Joan.
No, he was.
Yeah, Dame Joan.
Never,
do you mind?
Less than respectful.
No, he's a gentleman. He's an absolute gentleman. And then one last thing, but in terms of the hard sell, the review section at the back of the magazine, the Empire viewing guide is Doctor Strange. Scott Derrickson, the director, talks us through some of the film's key moments. The Empire masterpiece is Blowout. Hayley Campbell talking about that. We have an exclusive Q&A with John Waters talking about Multiple Maniacs, which is perhaps one of his lesser known films. Helen here.
Hi.
Spoke to Denis Villeneuve,
yes.
And
the production Patrice center, Villemette.
Patrice, your French is so good.
Merci.
Patrick Fermat, about the creating the heptapod language for Arrival. Mm. Lenny James, this month's Best of Times, Worst of Times. There's a really interesting feature on all the different gunfights at the OK Corral throughout the years. It's all good. Oh, and there's a massive, massive piece with Ken Loach, Hayley Squires and Dave Johns talking about I, Daniel Blake, and yes, a certain film critic, not of this parish, is mentioned. Right, so there you go. That is a cracking issue.
Yes,
it's
get
a good
it.
Issue. Get after it. £4.50 right now. All good and evil news agents on sale for the next 4 weeks or so.
Do it.
I got this. Right. Should we talk about some other movie news?
Other
yes.
movie news.
What
yes.
is there? What could possibly exceed the new issue of Empire?
There have been three The Predator stories this week. Three. Mm. Which is unusual.
Three.
Three The Predator, yeah.
Neither
to four nor to two shall ye count, but to three shall be the number.
Well, quite. Three. So there was, first of all, there was the cast shot, which showed them all together, mm-hmm. including Wee Little Tremblay.
Wee Little Tremblay.
Actually, you said Weird Little Tremblay. Yeah, I was going, that's getting
he's
strangely
weird.
Personal.
He's just wee.
He is very wee. And it's kind of, it's very alarming to see someone that small and vulnerable in the cast of a Predator movie. He is actually Predator.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He was out of costume as
Predator.
As
a Predator. That's good. That's fine.
He's wearing a little yellow anorak. But
yeah, so Tremblay,
but that was quite sweet. And then we had two casting confirmations. We had Yvonne Strahovski, who I will eternally associate with Chuck.
Naturally.
Theon Greyjoy, a.k.a. Alfie Allen.
Alfie Allen, yes.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell your Alfie Allen story?
Can I? Oh, God. Is this a good thing to share?
We put it in the magazine.
Did we?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I missed that. Okay, so my Alfie Allen story. This, I was out on a press trip in LA, and we were at the Chateau Marmont. Now, anyone knows the Chateau Marmont is a posh place where lots of famous people go. But for those of you who are not posh, you can't go into the hotel. You go into the little bar that's attached to it, where liggers and hangers-on drink, which is where we were. But I think
they put you there.
What, in the liggers and hangers-on?
James Dyer.
This was prior to my becoming the triumphant James Dyer.
His apotheosis.
Yeah. So.
He is becoming.
Anyway, we were there and we were having a few drinks, and I did the classic bar thing. I turned around and I spilled someone's pint. As it turns out, it wasn't a pint. It was a very expensive cocktail, and it was indeed held by Alfie Allen.
No.
And he had had, I think, and Helen, as my lawyer, you could censor me as I believe it is my belief he had maybe had several of these previously, for he was in his cups, as it were, and he took it ill. And
oh, no.
Was I've turned into Shakespeare. I'm not sure why. No, he wasn't. He wasn't overly happy.
Did you bite your thumb at me, sir?
Yeah, that's what
he
said.
I bite my thumb, sir.
A plague on both your houses. Yeah, no, he got a bit grumpy that I'd spilled his cocktail, and we had that sort of classic thing, the did you spill my drink? You spilled my drink, and it went back and forth, and I got quite British and apologised to him, and was quite contrite about the whole thing, even though I'm literally 3 feet taller than him. you know, really, I was just like, yeah, that's right, come on then, winter is coming, motherfucker, come on, bring it. No, it wasn't like that at all. I apologised profusely, and he accepted my apology, and we went our separate ways.
Wow, that's a great ending to that anecdote.
It didn't end in brawling through the streets of LA, I'm sorry to say. Oh.
In fairness, when I said, tell me your Alfie Allen story, I remembered it being more interesting. But I'm glad you shared it.
Yeah.
Now we just have to decide whether we keep it in or not. But we left enough cutting points.
I hate you both.
Okay. So the Predator... I'm wildly excited about this. I'm very, very on board. Shane Black, as you know, I worship the ground he walks on, which makes it awkward for him.
It really does. I've been in those interviews and, oh my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a grudging mutual respect.
Right.
Yeah, I think.
I think you should try doing the interview from a sitting position rather than hugging his feet next time. I think that might help.
Yeah. Humping his leg was perhaps.
It was a little far.
A little far.
Yeah.
But he's amazing. I think he's a great, great screenwriter. And I think he's pretty much 3 for 3. Nice Guys had some issues as a director as well. And the fact that he's returning to The Predator, or to Predator, the film, of course, which effectively launched him all those years ago. Although he exited stage right fairly quickly. Left? Stage left? Stage right?
Stage left, pursued by
stage left. But what happens if you're pursued by a predator? Do you go stage left or stage right?
It's whichever way, you know, that seems safest, I guess. I don't know.
So I'm excited about this. The cast is very, very good. So you got the likes of Trevante Rhodes
from Moonlight, amazing.
Yep. Who plays the older Chiron Black in Moonlight. We also have Sterling K. Brown. This
he
is
was
Us.
Incredible in The People vs. OJ.
Yeah, he was very good in that. I haven't seen This Is Us, and people rave about that show. And Boyd Holbrook, and we'll be talking about him later on when we talk about Logan. He's a really, really great up and coming actor as well. Jacob, little Jacob Tremblay, and Olivia Munn, and who else? There's one other person who was in that cast. There was one other person.
I was trying to get the picture up, and it wouldn't come. Keegan-Michael Key.
Keegan-Michael Key. Now that's interesting because he's obviously traditionally known as a comedian, but then so is his comedic partner Jordan Peele, and look what he's doing.
Exactly.
And you can read about that in the pages of Empire magazine. Just £4.50,
bringing it full circle. Amazing.
Good. And evil news agents. Jane Bow, you are, it's fair to say, I'm probably the biggest Shane Black fan in the office, but
yeah,
you are, I would say, an even bigger Predator fan than me.
They call
and Helen,
me.
You love Predator as
I
well.
I love
but
Predator.
He is, I think it's fair to say, the numero uno Predator Rono.
They do call me the demon that makes trophies of men.
Don't do a Spanish accent.
We've talked about this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, no, but it's a brilliant film. It's just
so good.
it's so ludicrously testosterone-driven that I just find it intensely soothing and relaxing to watch.
What I love about it is they were picking out guns for people, and for Jesse Ventura, they pulled a gun off a helicopter, and said, "Jesse, do you want to just carry this thing around?" They had to. It was literally held by a crane, and the ammunition was housed on a giant, like 3-foot-high pallet behind him.
Yeah,
I mean, it's ludicrous, but that then became part of video game culture, movie culture. Like, miniguns are de rigueur, and it's all because of Old Painless. I mean, it's just it's spectacular.
It is.
That
really
film
is
just amazing. It is the most quotable of all Arnie's films. It is, it's godly.
Oh, so good. So many great lines. And it's that stripped down kind of ridiculous propulsiveness of it that, you know, that you've got to hope that Shane Black still has. I mean, because he'll bring the humour. We know that. He's got the great lines. We know that. Mm-hmm. But just the sheer macho ridiculous oomph of it. I
the midair arm wrestle
that
just kind of lays out the stall, doesn't it?
Like, for no reason
bulging
whatsoever.
Rippling. I mean, it's just, but the thing is that,
you okay? do you want to take a moment?
Came over real funny. The thing is though that franchise has been dragged through the mud quite a lot. I mean, it's suffered a great many indignities since that first film came out. I mean, I have a soft spot for Predator 2. It's not a bad film at all. It's a very different film. It's not as good, but it's not bad. But you've had Alien vs. Predator, Alien vs. Predator. You've had
enjoyed Predators. I can say from your reaction that you're on the
I did watch at least most of it again recently when I just flicked on TV and there it was, and
I think it probably would have been better had they been able to fulfill their original plan and have Arnie as Dutch in the Lawrence Fishburne role, which I believe was the intention initially. And if that had happened,
Think that would have helped.
That would have been really cool, I think. Well, I enjoyed it. It was a good, solid Predator movie.
I mean, we're going to talk about the other great monster of that sort of ilk in a minute, because there's also Alien Covenant news this week. But I think both of those have suffered some diminishing sequels, and it has not ultimately diminished the original. And I think what both franchises are trying to do is go back to what made the original work as well as it did and try and recapture some of that magic while bringing something new to it. And if they can, this could be a really exciting year for both Alien and Predator, but not necessarily Alien versus Predator fans.
That's never speak of Alien versus Predator, either of those movies, again. It's a real toss-up which one of those is the worst movie. I think it's the second one. I think Requiem is just it's an abomination, as is a Pred Alien at the end of the film.
Yeah.
But they're just lamentable. But going back to the idea of Shane Black doing this, someone who was a cast member in the first movie directing a sequel to that movie 30 years on. What if Alien Covenant hadn't been directed by Ridley Scott, but what if it had been directed by one of the members of the cast of Aliens? Now, which one would you want that to be?
Al Matthews. Sure, why not?
Okay. Paul Reiser's Alien Covenant.
Ooh,
think
that
of
would
it.
Be good.
Think of it. Has he shown any talent behind the camera? I don't know, but I just know it would be great.
Well, glad we've got that sorted then. Hey, Alien Covenant, though. They have released, first of all, the cast shot of the crew of the Covenant, the ship. And they're all gathered around. I know a little bit about that. Well, some of it's been posted online in the other news, which was a clip about 4 minutes long, was released this morning. So this is the clip of the crew of the Covenant, which is also carrying colonists, but the crew having their sort of last supper, having successfully launched the ship, set it on course, everything seems to be going well, so they're about to go into cryosleep. So that's kind of that scene, and we see Michael Fassbender's AI Walter checking them all over before they go into cryosleep. You may have picked up on it from that clip. I think you probably have. They're all couples. The idea is that this is a colony, so they haven't sent off any single people, because we all know what happens when they do that. They turn into Chris Pratt and go a bit nuts. So instead, they've sent off paired up couples, and that gives it a little bit of an interesting flavour. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out when they all start, let's face it, dying horribly.
What?
Dude. I also love the fact that if you look at the Alien Covenant badge in one of the pictures, the stills that they've released, there is quite a close-up of the badge. If you look at the image at the bottom of that of that sort of logo, you may recognise something from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
What? What is it?
Well, the Ark of the Covenant, basically.
The what?
It's the Ark. The Ark of the Covenant with angel things on top with the wings touching.
It's the big gold suitcase.
Oh, the big gold. Why are you saying that?
I'm sorry.
Indiana Jones and the Big Gold Suitcase. That's what that film's called.
Raiders of the Big Gold Suitcase.
I'm excited about Alien Covenant. I've decided, though, from this point forward, I am not going to watch any more clips. I'm not going to watch any more trailers because I don't want to know anything else. I've seen the first trailer and it is pretty explicit in the fate of a major character. And I just, in fact, fate of several characters.
Yes.
And I don't want to know going in. I don't want to know. I knew a lot, as you do, about Alien Covenant, I think. Mm. I knew a lot about Prometheus going into Prometheus, and it does take something away, I think, of you. And sometimes it's unavoidable.
I mean, one of us has to take this bullet for each of these big films, you
know? This adamantium bullet, this magic bullet.
All right, enough of your X-Men Origins Wolverine fandom, Chris.
Magic Bullet is a JFK reference, Helen, I think you'll find.
Yeah, but the adamantium one wasn't.
Well, that's true.
And it could have been a reduced Shakespeare Company reference.
It could have been.
They do
it could have been. But I'm still very... I'm as excited about this as...
Can be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Should we talk about Hellboy 3?
Because it's not happening.
It's not happening.
Yeah, it's not happening.
And that's from Guillermo himself having apparently talked to everybody involved. So all of those of you still holding out hope, and I think it was an increasingly frail hope, if I'm honest, that hope can now be laid peacefully.
He tweeted, and I quote, "Hellboy 3, sorry to report, spoke with all parties, must report that 100% the sequel will not happen, and that is to be the final thing about it." Well, sounds pretty definitive.
It does rather sound definitive. But hey, you know, stranger things have happened in Hollywood.
Yeah, it sounds like some sort of chicanery has been going on behind the scenes. Yeah. Maybe some people disagree. Maybe the studio holds the rights, didn't really want to spend the money for whatever Hellboy 3 would have been. We can imagine it would have been pretty big and pretty apocalyptic in certain places. Mm. Who knows? Maybe there were creative wrangles. But, you know, maybe also it's been a while since Hellboy 2. And perhaps the number crunchers, the bean counters, looked at it and went, well, if this film comes out in 2018, 2019, almost a decade after the last one, perhaps people won't know what Hellboy is, and that's a bit of a risk. But it's a shame, because we know how much the character means to Guillermo and to Ron Perlman. And it's also something really easy to ask him in interviews.
When you're just going to have to work harder, Chris. Come
on. Of questions. You just go, Hellboy 3? And then that's you're good.
Yeah,
little insight into my interview technique there, folks.
And that's why he doesn't do them in the office.
Yeah. Speaking of monsters, though, which a Hellboy isn't, that's a bit harsh. But Godzilla, King of the Monsters, King of Monsters, is ramping up. Obviously, in the meantime, we've got Kong Skull Island to come. But Godzilla King of the Monsters will be out 2018, and then followed by Kong versus Godzilla in 2020, I think is the plan. But there has been some casting news. We already had Millie Bobby Brown of Stranger Things on board. We now have the excellent Kyle Chandler joining her. So that's good news. I mean, I assume he plays her dad. He just tends to play dads. I may be wrong, but it's probably a dad. And we have Krampus's Michael Dougherty directing from a script that he wrote with Zach Shields. So that's kind of most of what we have. Ken Watanabe may be back reprising his role from 2014. But that isn't officially confirmed yet.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, sorry, King of the Monsters is King of Monsters is 2019, not 2018.
Okay,
which makes more sense.
Okay, cast coming together. We like Kyle Chandler; he's very, very good.
We love him. Yeah, he's great in Manchester by the Sea. If you haven't seen that already,
he
obviously has to stretch there to play somebody called Joe Chandler.
I know it's tough.
It's a job, and he manages.
Yeah, he does. He certainly does. Just a couple of last things before we move on. So we had some speculation on the podcast recently that The Mummy, which is coming out this year, is the first of the Universal Monsters franchise that is being relaunched, which will have Dracula and the Wolfman and all sorts of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And there was some speculation because remember when Tom Cruise was attached to a Van Helsing movie as well?
Yes.
And then that went away. And then someone on Twitter suggested it, and I liked the idea that Tom Cruise might actually be playing in disguise or stealth or however you want to say it, Van Helsing, or he'll be revealed to be Van Helsing in The Mummy, and then we'll go on to star in all the other movies and fight all the other Universal monsters.
He's a sort of John Harrison Van Helsing, is what
you're
thinking. Yes. Okay.
I'm not sure if this news knocks that for six or not. But so a new writer, Dan Mazo, who wrote Wrath of the Titans, is coming on to write Universal's Van Helsing movie. He's replacing two good writers, Eric Heisserer and John Spates.
Oh, right, okay. Of Arrival and Prometheus, respectively.
Yes,
right?
One of whom may well win an Oscar this weekend. And the other one, of course, is John Spates. And Dan Mazo, it's interesting. He's on board. He's writing it. But is he writing it for Tom Cruise? We don't know.
If your theory were right,
yes,
and Cruise were a stealth Van Helsing,
yes, it's not my theory.
Okay, the theory.
I don't remember whose
theory
it is.
Wouldn't you
go
from the Mummy into a Van Helsing to?
You could do that.
There is a slightly higher brow, possibly news. However, Martin Scorsese's new film is headed to Netflix, The Irishman, which is not really about an Irishman. It's about a mob hitman called Frank the Irishman Sheeran. Is now headed to Netflix, so this is a sort of big budget movie, and I guess, you know, to get the kind of freedom that he wants, and let's face it, deserves, he's going with Netflix for that. So this is a reunion with Robert De Niro, who would be playing Sheeran, presumably, and this is the guy who's allegedly responsible for killing Jimmy Hoffa.
It's going to be very interesting, and this, of course, has a mocap component where we'll see a younger version of De Niro and maybe a younger version of Al Pacino as well, and possibly even Joe Pesci if they do indeed sign on a line that is dotted. And this is a fascinating move as well to go to Netflix, because this is a movie Scorsese's been trying to make for a long, long time. He has a deal in place at Paramount, who have been very, very good partners to him, I think, over the last few years, and The Wolf of Wall Street and Silence. They certainly give him his head, but are Netflix going to give him his head in an even greater way and give him complete and utter freedom? And Netflix seem to be positioning themselves now as some sort of haven for filmmakers. I certainly saw some people suggest that maybe that's where Hellboy 3 might end up if Guillermo wanted to take it there. I don't think it's up to him.
No.
I think that's why it's not happening. But it's certainly very interesting. Now, of course, the downside of this is that if you start giving filmmakers complete and utter carte blanche or carte blanchette, then Heaven's Gate could happen. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing now, because obviously we look at Heaven's Gate and we think it's a classic, but United Artists and it back in the at the tail end of the 70s, 80s.
It's the perennial problem of filmmaking, isn't it? Yeah. It's they're expensive collaborations to do, to accomplish, and sometimes they go horrifically wrong. And to be honest, I mean, I was reading an article yesterday saying, which was rather inside baseball, talking about Paramount's sort of difficult year last year. Chairman Brad Gray has just left. They're not entirely sure who's going to be the new chairman yet. So there's a little bit of flux there, which may be...
James, you offer it?
I'm just like, I'm busy, man. I've got stuff, you know.
Just, you know.
I can't just drop everything and go...
Chris, I have many, many public appointments that I now need to fulfill. So.
Your calendar is full. I'm excited about this, though, and I think anything that gives Scorsese and De Niro a chance to team up is good.
Yeah, that is exciting.
Okay, so time now for this week's guest. Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
Gore Verbinski is one of the most visually inventive directors in Hollywood, I would argue. Across a long career containing the likes of Mouse Hunt, The Weatherman, the first three Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and The Lone Ranger. He's moved away from the big budget realm for perhaps understandable reasons, given the reception meted out to The Lone Ranger, with this week's oddball horror, A Cure for Wellness, which features Dane DeHaan, Jason Isaacs, hello to Jason Isaacs, and plenty of creepy eels. Ironically enough, I needed a cure for illness when I went along to interview him, as you will soon find out. Enjoy. I'm not sick during the interview, but I was beforehand.
Thanks. Ew.
I mean, I didn't...
No, please, don't explain further.
Here's Gore Verbinski. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the director of A Cure for Wellness, Mr. Gore Verbinski. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you doing?
not too bad. You're a bit jet-lagged.
A little bit, yeah. I'm not quite sure where we are right now. But
oh, really? Okay.
We'll get through it.
We're in a lovely hotel suite.
We're in a hotel suite.
Yeah, there we go. This is something we don't see very often these days, which is a true original based on nothing but your own dark imagination.
Yeah, they're tough to get made these days, not having a theme park ride or a toy or a book or some sort of superhero.
Yes.
Somehow, I'm not quite sure how, we were sort of left alone. We went to Germany and made this little contemporary gothic nightmare.
How did it come about?
Working with Justin Haith, the writer, we were sort of playing with this idea that, you know, narrative as a sort of disease, as a kind of sickness. Mm-hmm. We're big fans of movies of the 70s where there was really a sense of something inevitable happening in the narrative, and almost like it's an invisible force or like a black spot on your X-ray, and
yeah.
a sort of cancer that's pulling the camera down the corridor and pulling the protagonist towards his epiphany. And we're just sort of playing with those ideas, and that led to this sort of health spa in the Alps that was, you know, slightly borrowed from Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, but then kind of perverted and corrupted in which our own way.
Which we see at one point. We see a character.
Yeah, we've got one of the people who work at the Institute reading the book in the background there, if you're paying attention.
Which I was, point for me. There we go. So the idea comes about. It's interesting that you said, '70s paranoid mm-hmm. thriller. So I imagine you're thinking about movies like The Parallax View, 3 Days of the Condor in a strange way, is
well,
it?
Well, more, there's this...
The Conversation, maybe?
There's a film by Polanski called The Tenant.
Oh, of course.
Which has always been one of my favorite movies. And Joseph Losey's The Servant. Uh-huh. These sort of psychological, Don't Look Now, of course.
Yes.
And there's just a real, you know, there's a sense of overt style in those films, but it's not like somebody's wearing the wrong dress to the party, you know, it's really in service of the narrative. But so really, you know, the composition and sound become very important, so you feel like you're, you know, everything has a kind of purpose and intention, even though the protagonist might be oblivious or in denial in this case. You know, the sort of story itself is conspiring, you know.
Yes, absolutely. I detected, or I thought it detected anyway, notes of some of the great horror films. There were elements Wicker Man. There's a lot of Hammer horror in this movie for me. The Shining is in there as well. Is that
The Innocence? Do you know that film?
I do know The Innocence.
That's a beautiful movie.
Yeah,
That was. I love that tune in The Innocence that she sings. Mm. The Willow song. It's beautiful. So, look, I think if you wanted to make a giraffe with an alligator's head, you'd have to have seen a giraffe and an alligator. So we're kind of, you know, we're this is a language that I grew up with, and, you know, and we're sort of bringing it to bear. I mean, the thing about the genre that's really, really fun is, you know, we get to conduct a psychological experiment on people in a darkened room. You're observing Dane's character Lockhart as he kind of arrives at this place and reluctantly becomes a patient at the sanatorium. But really, you're the patient, you know, and we're sort of preying upon your motivation to discover, and I think you're letting us in.
You put Dane DeHaan through hell on earth during this movie.
Yeah, but he's young.
He's malleable.
Yes, he's eager. we did. He was a trooper. I mean, he's in almost every scene, so there's no time in the trailer, you know.
Yeah.
He's just on set from dusk till dawn.
And it's tough psychologically, it's tough physically. As a director, are there ever times you feel, I'm maybe pushing him a bit too far, or do you...
Well, there was a moment when we had him strapped in the tank, you know, where the reflection was sort of leaving his body, and so the water has to rise and he has to remain horizontal, and he was harnessed in and wired in to the tank itself, and the water's rising, and you know, we're shooting in Germany, and I don't speak German, and we have, you know, the German safety divers are in the tank, and we have a series of hand signals, and there's the definitely, you know, slit your throat, like, I want out. And there's which is, you know, binary. And then there's the thumbs up, or the okay sign, where everything's good. And then there was this sign, which was sort of the kind of waving your hand back and forth slightly.
Okay.
It was sort of like, something's wrong, I'm not sure what it is.
Sure.
So that was being used a lot, and we're rolling, and it was like, what's the problem? What's the problem? Well, as the water's rising, right, he can't equalize. Of course. Duquette, he's got a mask on. Yes. And so the pressure in his ears was getting worse and worse. And finally, we had to, the divers had to come in and cut him out. We have not, there's like, the emergency release was basically a knife, God. Cutting the cables. And he got to the surface and, it was 10 minutes of kind of, okay, that's not a very good signal when it sort of doesn't tell you exactly what's wrong.
It's, yeah.
And we're rolling and the water's rising and there's massive pumps filling this tank. So it's rising quite quickly. Things like that, falling off a bike with the cast on the back of a bike and sort of hopping on one foot. We put him through a lot, but he was game.
I'm reminded of Sam Raimi with Bruce Campbell on the Evil Dead movies, who used to take just great pride in torturing Bruce as much as he possibly could. He would poke him with sticks and twigs and branches. You haven't quite gone that far.
We didn't really need to. It was all on the page.
It was all there. Can I ask as well about Jason Isaacs? You've cast a national treasure. I don't know if you're aware of how revered Jason Isaacs is in this country. We hold parades in his honor every July.
I like to poke him with sticks. No, Jason is. Look, I've been a fan forever. I mean, he's masterful and delicious. I mean, that's the word that comes to mind. We talked a lot. Jason and I talked a lot about Vollmer. I was almost pulling back on that deliciousness because I think the real horror of this place is, the louder you scream, there's somebody offering you a terry cloth robe and a pair of slippers and saying it's wonderful. So there's a kind of cult-like, and for a cult leader to sort of get you drinking the Kool-Aid, he has to be, he has to care. And I think the thing that was key to that performance was that there's a real cost to helping these people, to healing these people. It's a calling, and that his concern is genuine. And I think, I remember being a kid and sent to the principal's office very young, like 7 years old, and the principal was just this figure of power, this tall, bald man, and scary. And so your defenses are up, and you're kind of sitting in the principal's office going, I'm so angry at my teacher and what she said and what you sit down at the desk and he just says, is everything okay at home? And you just start crying. There's something about that, the unexpected turn and not playing him in any way as a villain, really.
Yes.
And the best villains, I think, are right. And I think with the exception of this one slight flaw in Vollmer, the sort of purification obsession. He's correct about his diagnosis about modern man and about Lockhart in particular. So the movie's really, two worlds. And I don't think Lockhart or Hannah really belong in either of them.
How much of this movie was a response to the experience you went through on The Lone Ranger? Was it something that played in your...
Well, it was nice to step away from... Look, the movie's not for everybody, And I think when you make a movie that's based on a big ride or an intellectual property that has those expectations, certainly you get the means. you can't do what David Lean did today without some sort of giant robot in your movie or God knows what. So you're not going to get, so you have, it's a double-edged sword, but you have to kind of, that's the kind of the four quadrant movie, right?
Yeah, of course. So, yes.
I think when you make a movie like this, you can say, look, it's not for you. You can take not an age bracket or male or female, but a sort of user profile, yes. If you will, you can sort of say, if you don't like these types of movies, don't come. We made it for a price where we're okay if you don't come. What I mean? But we want to find its champions, and I think they're out there.
Yeah.
So it is liberating. I think it's a kind of a reboot.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I was driving at, because that experience. I don't know how much you want to talk about The Lone Ranger now, or whether what happened hurts, because it feels, from the outside looking in, And we had Armie Hammer on the podcast as well, or we will have. It's due out in March. And talking about what he felt going through that as well, where you feel that you're on a movie and suddenly the whole world is ganging up against you.
Yeah.
Before they've even seen it.
Yeah.
As a director of that, what was that experience like?
Well, you have to be, like, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. I mean, yep. You could, you know, 1 year you're getting the Academy Award for an animation movie that you had no idea how to make an animated movie. You just did it, you know? And then then you're being lynched. And, you know, that's part of the gig. I mean, you have to approach every movie like it's your last. We certainly, when we were making the first Pirates of the Caribbean film, everybody said, you're crazy, you're making a pirate movie. Those don't work, you know? Mm-hmm. So you're constantly tinkering with things and you know, hoping that something blows up in your face. And I don't know how to describe it, except that these are opportunities to learn and to try new things and to try to find that boundary where you're nervous. You're not sure if you're going to pull it off. And certainly taking, the sort of beloved Lone Ranger narrative and saying, you know, let's tell it from Tonto's perspective. That was going to, I don't know what it was exactly, but for me, that was what the exciting part of it was, to sort of kind of invert the whole narrative. And so I was very passionate about it and I still enjoy the movie. So, you try to, get into that same spirit you've had on any movie when you approach it, which is you're going to put everything you possibly can into it. And then, the releasing of the movie is a completely different, it's a different, I can't think in those terms while you're making it, just trying to make a good story.
Yeah. And I guess Armie said as well that he's experienced over the years since the movie came out, a lot of people coming up to him and saying they loved it and it's one of their favorite films. And has the same happened to you? Have you found that there's been this?
Yeah, I think that there's been a real sort of, everybody jumped on the kind of hate it wagon, and then I think some people have actually watched it, with it, didn't sort of read Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, and just sort of came up with their own perspective, and that's always nice,
The IMDb, in its infinite wisdom, says your next movie is untitled Gore Verbinski Project. Is this true?
It is an untitled Gore Verbinski Project. Yeah.
What can you say about that? What's next for you?
I actually have a few things that I'm cooking that are all have been on the back burner. That as soon as we're done with this press tour, I'm going to be sitting with a few really talented writers, and we're going to kind of get back to work. So I don't know which one of them will actually be next.
Okay, interesting. But no spa treatments for you?
No, I'm going to take a break from the spa.
Fair enough, Gore Verbinski. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now a word about our sponsor, Mustard.co.uk. Life's all about options, but when it comes to getting the right car, van or motorbike insurance, how do you know you've chosen the right policy? Well, at Mustard.co.uk, their online price guarantee means you get exactly what you need from some of the best deals on the market. When it comes to getting you great insurance, you can count on Mustard.co.uk. So whoever you are, whatever you drive, get comparing and see if you can get covered for less with Mustard.co.uk. Okay, time for the week's reviews. Let's start with Logan, which is out next Wednesday. Normally we talk about it in next week's podcast, but why not? Let's do it now, because there's no embargo. And one of the reasons there's no embargo is because it's very, very good.
It's really good.
And this is, of course,
this is the final swan song, if you will, for Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, as Logan.
It is.
And he wanted to go out with a bang, and I think he has done that. So this is set in about 2029. Logan is older. He's slowing down. The metal in his body is essentially poisoning him, and his healing factor has slowed enough that it's now struggling to cope. He is working as a limo driver and in a border town in the US and looking after Professor X, who is now 90-something, mm-hmm. and living in a makeshift facility south of the border, and he's basically hustling for the money to keep him in medication. And this kind of hard scrabble life is slightly upturned when he meets a young girl called Laura, who's played by Daphne Keane, who's astonishing. She is on the run And while Logan wants absolutely nothing to do with her whatsoever, he is sort of forced to step up and get involved in this girl's life, essentially by Charles's influence and circumstance. And the three of them are basically on the run from Donald Pierce, who's played by Boyd Holbrook. And his Reavers, and they have to go on the run. This is a world where no new mutants have been born in about 25 years, yet Laura seems to have mutant abilities. What's going on? And then it goes from there.
It goes from there indeed. What do we make of it?
I think it's triumphant. But in all seriousness,
can we have a moratorium on that word after this podcast?
Yes, we can. No, I loved it. I thought it was great. I have mixed feelings, by which I mean I hate the former two Wolverine movies, but this is just so good, and just the whole emotional tone of it is completely different. I mean, it's been referred to as the Marvel movie for people who hate Marvel movies, which is reductive, but there's an element of that to it. You know, it has a bit of Unforgiven in it, it's got a bit of Shane in it, it's got a little bit of Little Miss Sunshine in it.
A little bit of The Wrestler as well.
Yes, indeed. I mean, he's old, he's cantankerous, you know, he's not the kind of immortal, you know, scrapping Logan that we've come to sort of know and love. And the relationship that he has with X-23, spoilers, with Laura is fantastic. You know, it's really emotional. It has, if any of you have played The Last of Us, it has a lot of that in it, the Joel and Ellie relationship. Really, and I'm not ashamed to say that I shed a tear at one point in that film.
Did you?
Yeah, I did indeed.
So when I stole your popcorn?
Yeah.
No, it is. It's really good. I think, so I did the interviews, obviously, with these people for this film a few months back, and it is really, really good to see. Sometimes, you know, you go and you talk to people about their hopes for a film and what they're planning to do and what they're trying to achieve with the film, and you see the finished result, and it hasn't lived up to that, and it hasn't done what they set out to do for various reasons. It's usually just things have gone wrong somewhere along the way. And in this case, this is absolutely, I think, the film that they set out to make. The studio, God bless them, has given them complete support to do some really risky things. This is an R-rated film, which I think the fans have been clamoring for, but this is a really hard R. I mean, this is very, very violent.
Many people getting claws to the head.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unapologetic about how adult it is. The first word is an F word. The first scene involves several violent deaths, and it spirals off from there. One of the first things Professor X says, even though he's dropped the F-bomb, both Wolverine and Professor X have dropped F-bombs in previous X-Men movies, but here there's a lot of F-bomb dropping. And when Patrick Stewart says the F-word, and I had to leave the room. I had a bit of a fit at the vapors, I'm afraid, and had to go and lie down for a bit. I think this movie is a fantastic, fantastic film. I think it, we'll talk about it. We're going to have a spoiler special podcast.
Yes.
For this, you may be pleased to know, with James Mangold. Helen and I sat down with him yesterday for almost an hour, and we talked about this film, and he's a brilliant, brilliant talker.
He is passionate, you guys, passionate.
And we'll get into all the bits and pieces and the third act stuff, and we'll get into it all there, but I think this is a great, great film. I think for the first hour, I thought it was going to be the best X-Men film of them all, and I know there are people who do feel that way. I feel it doesn't quite live up to it, but this is a really confident movie. It's a movie that knows what it wants to be from the off. It's bold and it's brave and it's unexpected and it's moving, and yeah, absolutely full marks
and uniformly great performances, like
absolutely
across the board, stunning stuff.
I genuinely feel that this is a sort of movie that, and I know this is going to sound stupid, but Patrick Stewart in this movie in particular, for me, is Oscar worthy in this. I'm not saying give him a statue. I'm saying he's Oscar nomination worthy. I'm saying next year he should be in the running. And Jackman as well, and Daphne Keane. They're all very, very, very good. And they have more to do. They've more meat on the bones this time of their characters than they ever have. And for actors to do that, 9th time around for Jackman, 7th time around for Stewart, that's pretty phenomenal.
Yeah.
And relatively unheard of, I would say, compared to, say, Connery on his 7th go around, or Roger Moore with Bond.
It's a very different thing.
Very different era, of course, but I think this is great. It's got really good action sequences as well. I really, really liked it.
Especially
second time around, I think I liked it more.
Me too. We were discussing this yesterday. I think I was very, very keen on it first time around. I loved it even more second time around. So it grew on me further. We had the same thing with Civil War. Maybe we were going into both a little bit hyped. But
now, Civil War, what, 10th time around.
Oh, so
it's,
good.
It's better than How Green Was My Valley. So it's better than the movie that's better than the best movie ever made.
That is
Die Hard.
Pretty damn good.
That sounds like an Armageddon riff. It's better than shaking the hand of the
I just wanted to shake the hand of the daughter of the bravest man I ever met.
That's right.
So there we go. 4 stars for Logan. It is a cracking film. And if you don't like X-Men movies, this is going to be up your street. Our Lizzie Beardsworth hadn't seen any X-Men movies going into this movie, and she really loved it. So
it lives up to the promise of that early teaser with the Johnny Cash cover.
Very
I
much
think
so.
That's the highest
yeah.
praise you can give it.
It's elegiac and haunting. Is the sort of thing you would say on the poster or maybe the DVD. I'm just saying.
On, who's going to put any of us on the DVD cover?
I'm just saying, if you want to have the poster, the DVD cover of Logan in about 6 months' time and you had Elegaic and Haunting, Chris Hewitt, Empire Podcast on there, I'm just saying.
Give it up, Chris.
It's triumphant. Next up, Cure for Wellness. Dane DeHaan versus the Eels.
It kind of is,
not,
isn't it?
Not the band. I'd pay to see either one of those movies, quite frankly.
Right, so Dane DeHaan is a hard-working New York yuppie type. You know the thing, he's up for the big promotion, but his boss gives him an assignment. He's got to go to Europe to bring back this partner in his company to sign certain documents and cover up certain things. If not, they're going to be hung on Dane DeHaan. So it's his job on the line, basically, his reputation. He has to get this partner to come back from this spa where he went for 3 weeks and has stayed for a little bit longer than that, and get him to basically take on his responsibilities again. The problem is when Dane DeHaan gets there, because he thinks this is going to be fine, this is not going to be a problem. His character's Lockhart. When he gets there, he discovers that the partner is refusing to leave, and that Dr. Vollmer, head of the spa, played by Jason Isaacs, has something a bit sinister going on. So soon Dane DeHaan finds himself among the patients in the spa and starts investigating a series of unfortunate events, if you will, and certainly strange things involving an improbable number of eels.
There's,
I mean, I don't know where,
so
what else to say without ruining
eely good.
I would not say it's eely good, but you might.
I probably
would. Would you say it's more good or... more or less a... Oh.
Anyway,
when I saw this movie, I wanted to do a conga around the conga.
Yeah. No, it's terrible.
Yeah, so this is a film, and it's an odd one, isn't it? So from a craft point of view, it's kind of hard to fault early on in that it's beautifully shot.
It's gorgeous, yeah.
I mean, the locations are fantastic. And it has that real sort of old school psychological horror feel to it, where it's not so much scary as it is just very unsettling. It's very eerie. You can't put your finger on why it is, and you're not really sure what's going on. And there are moments in it. So there's a particular early on where he's walking through the steam bath, and he's his legs in a cast. He's using crutches, and just the foley artistry on the creak the crutches make. This repetitive creak of the metal is quite unsettling. And then there's the steam, and then some slightly weird things happening there. I mean, from my point of view, it had a real feel of some of those older, like almost like the Silent Hill video games. You know, it's really just...
I was thinking that as well, and I'm not even a gamer, but Verbinski nearly made... Is it Biodome? That sort of
Bioshock.
Steampunk... Bioshock, that steampunky underwater game. And there's a little bit, from what I've seen, of that. It's beautiful. It's all, but it is all sort of welded iron tanks
and rivets and
things floating in water and looking really otherworldly and beautiful and weird and scary,
and many eels
and so many eels.
I mean, it's not period, but it feels period set, and it's a very curious thing. And I think I found it really effective for 3/4 of its runtime. And obviously one can't really go into spoilers, but there's a sense that, you know, the great mysteries are ones that leave lots of threads dangling, and the great mysteries are ones that pay off. And the problem with this is it doesn't. It's all build up, no payoff, because it's utter nonsense.
It
when
makes
you get
no
to the
sense.
End of it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really isn't. And the final 50 minutes honestly feel like an entirely separate film made by an entirely separate filmmaker, to the point where you're just going, I don't know what just happened.
Yeah. The story and the structure of this, I thought, were appallingly bad. But you know, I like the way it was designed. So I just, I was not I think I was probably less of a fan of this than you are. Either.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed it. And then at that point, when it turns, you think, well, the plot no longer makes any sense. I'm also ever so slightly offended by what's happening on screen. And I'm really quite irritated that I've spent the last 15 hours watching the build-up to it. So
yeah. It's long.
It is long. And I think if it had paid off, it wouldn't have felt so long. But the fact that it does crumble towards the end... yeah, it makes it feel more of an ordeal than it otherwise would have done. So,
potentially
wakefulness, maybe.
Potentially maybe half an hour too long.
Yeah,
but I think movies like this should be applauded. I think more filmmakers taking it reminded me a lot actually of Crimson Peak. It's working in that same.
There's a little bit that gothic.
Yeah,
Very very atmosphere oriented.
Do you like that pronunciation?
Incroyable.
Thank you very much indeed. And I liked how creepy and effective it was and unsettling. And then it just goes eel shit crazy. And I didn't mind that because certain actors...
Yeah.
Hello to the certain actors. Commit when the craziness goes.
Yeah. He really does.
I didn't say it was a he. I didn't say who it was. But, you know, you put Jason Isaacs in your film...
Yeah,
gotta use them. That's all I'm gonna say. Three stars.
We gave that film 3 stars.
I love the dismissive way you said that film. We gave that film
that
3 stars. Cure for Wellness, 3 stars. Yeah. And then lastly this week we have Patriots Day, which is the latest reteaming of Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg, and this is a procedural look at the events of the Boston Marathon bombings back in 2013.
Yeah, so this is basically places a fictional character, Sergeant Tommy Saunders, who's Mark Wahlberg's character, at the centre of all the events immediately prior to and subsequent to the Boston Marathon bombing. So all the search for the people responsible. It's the latest in that sort of blue collar average guy caught up in extraordinary situations series that Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg have been doing, obviously with Deepwater Horizon last year and Lone Survivor before that. This one to me is the least successful of all three. If I'm perfectly honest, I think it feels like he's a made up character because he's so central to so much of what happens in a way that feels unnatural when everything else is pretty fact based. So everybody else around him is working in their FBI teams or their, you know, local police teams or their whatever, you know, disaster relief teams. And it feels weird that there's this one guy who's sort of in the middle of all of them. The film makes some odd choices to focus very much on the police and not on any of the victims. There are almost no runner characters, which I thought was a bit of a shame personally, but maybe that's just me bringing my own thing to it. It also makes a very unfortunate decision with a Muslim FBI agent halfway through, which I think opens it to charges of being less sensitive than I think it would like to be as regards just sort of profiling of the bombers and everything else. It very much lets the authorities away with quite a lot of the decisions that they made in the aftermath, which were perhaps less than ideal. And I think it might have, you know, it does bring to life, it was all chaotic. They were trying to control things and also, you know, reopen the city, but keep everybody safe and this kind of stuff. I get that there's a conflict there, but they very much side with the police to the extent that they don't necessarily discuss really the fact that for quite a long time, people out there were looking for the wrong individuals and people's lives were put at risk because they'd been wrongly fingered as the suspect. So there were some, odd choices. But, you know, if you just watch it as a procedural, a search for the guys responsible, it has some powerful moments, as you'd expect from Peter Berg. He's very good at this sort of thing.
He is, isn't he?
And it's very much more, I think, a US story than an international one. But at the same time, if you're interested in the story, it gives you a bit of a start. So we give it 3 stars.
3 stars. So the least effective Hutch Parker produced movie out this week.
Yeah.
Along with Logan. After Logan.
After Logan. A long way back from Logan. Yeah.
So Patriots Day. 3 stars in for Patriots Day. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you in association with mustard.co.uk. Join us next week for more film-related fun. And we'll be joined by Sir Patrick Stewart.
Hurrah!
Star of Logan, amongst other things. And don't forget, of course, our John Wick Chapter 2 spoiler special with Keanu Reeves is up right now. You can listen to that right now. And our Logan one with James Mangold is on the way March 6th, I believe, for that one. All very exciting. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to write 5 stars on all the Attack of the Clones DVDs I can find, but my master plan is... I'll put James's name under it. Hey? Always thinking. See you next week. Bye.